We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start the testimony. And first is Mary Reagan. And next after her would be Jan Malcolm. I don't see any.
Ms. Reagan. She's not there yet.
Well, why don't we just start with Jan Malcolm then? And John Cheetah from Creighton High School.
A proud Raider, Mr. Chairman.
So would you state your names when you start your testimony for the tape, and although we know each other quite well.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Jan Malcolm, Chief Executive Officer of Courage Center, and my colleague John Cheetah, our Vice President of Public Affairs and Research, also from Courage Center. We appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon and to talk a little bit about the budget challenge facing the legislature, which is indeed a sobering one. Our main message today is that we ask you most sincerely to stay the course on the systemic health care reforms that the legislature has put in place. There are, under policy decisions you've already made, there are a number of, in our judgment, very important, very appropriate, long-term changes happening now in the health system overall and in the medical assistance system in specific that, unfortunately, from a current biennial budget challenge, need some time to play out. But our strong argument is that the legislature keep our collective eye on the prize of where we're trying to get with these long-term systemic changes and find a way to avoid making budget decisions in this biennium that will actually undermine our ability to do those more systemic changes going forward. In the case of the Health and Human Services budget, I know that you're painfully aware of the amount of cutting that's been done in each of the last couple of budget cycles with respect to disability services in particular. Those cuts, in our judgment, have been extraordinary and disproportionate in terms of the impact on vulnerable populations in our state and our ability to keep the service delivery system together going forward. Just in Courage Center's case, we are the state's largest nonprofit comprehensive provider of rehabilitation services. Of the 12,000 people we serve each year, about a third of them are medical assistance clients. And one thing I would like to just share with you, we are a very significant provider of medical assistance services, as you know. And we're not here arguing for the continuation of medical assistance coverage for physical, occupational, and speech therapy for adults because it's good business for Courage Center. Today, we lose $800 per person per year that we serve on medical assistance. Yet we come before you and ask you sincerely not to eliminate coverage for adults for speech, occupational, and physical therapy, even though quite ironically and candidly, eliminating those services would be a favor to us in terms of the bottom line impact on our budget. But it would be the absolute wrong thing to do for the community, certainly for the people we serve, but for the state's budget long term. These kinds of services, basic rehabilitation therapies, in my judgment, are the very definition of the kind of value-based health services that health reform is all about. The kinds of basic services that help to maintain people's health and independence, that help to avoid avoidable complications, deeper degrees of disability, long-term institutional costs that we will most surely face in the future if we were to cut off access to the very services that are helping to keep people healthy and independent today. So, Mr. Chairman, our message is a pretty straightforward one. You are on the right track in terms of the kind of systemic reforms that we're about the business of building here in Minnesota. But unfortunately, we see the very real possibility that unsustainable cuts in the short run in the very kind of basic services we need to build healthcare homes around and bundled payments around in the future we could actually be undermining our ability to do those longer-term reforms if we need to take yet another disproportionately deep round of cuts in the short term. We'd be very happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Well, I'm glad you talked about PT and OT, because that's certainly something that I don't want to cut, because in your case, you're dealing with people that have long-term issues, but people also have short-term needs for those, and the question is, are they going to stay in the hospital longer so they can get those services where the governor will allow inpatient?
Exactly.
So that will obviously come up later in, when we do the budget bill. Mm-hmm. John, did you want to?
Just here to provide any support or answer any detailed questions if needed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mary Reagan here yet? And after her will be Tim Rundle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of handouts, if I could. Apologize for being late. The Sears parking lot is full of lobbyists, I think. Not surprisingly. Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. I'm not here today, though, representing providers. I'm here today in an attempt to represent some very vulnerable children that will be impacted by the governor's supplemental budget proposal. The Children and Community Services Grant, CCSA, is reduced by 33%, or $22.5 million per year, in the governor's proposal. This was originally part of the governor's unallotment last spring, excuse me, and he is proposing to make this a permanent reduction. CCSA was created in 2003 by combining 15 different grants, both adult and children grants, with Title 20 federal funds into one consolidated fund. These grants include family preservation and children's mental health grants. The children's grants were reduced by $50 million at that time. The state dollars contained in the CCSA grants are the only state dollars in Minnesota's child welfare system, the only state dollars that go to counties to fund these services. Even prior to this proposed cut, Minnesota ranked close to the bottom of all the states in the country in state funding for child welfare services. The overall goal for CCSA is keeping children safe and improving their well-being. The target population are children, adolescents, and adults within the county who experience dependency, abuse, neglect, poverty, disability, and chronic health conditions. You have a handout in front of you that shows the allocation per county for 2010. This does include the 22.5 unallotment. So there is now a total of $44.5 million that goes to counties for these services. 7 years ago, this total was closer to $116 million. Counties are required to develop a plan with community input on how these dollars will be used to address these needs. The chart in front of you indicates how these dollars are spent by counties, and as you can see, over 70% are spent to protect children and provide mental health services for uninsured and underinsured children. We recognize the budget challenges you have and know the counties are also facing deficits that are forcing them to make very difficult decisions about their ability to respond to even these core child safety and well-being interventions. Over 5,400 children were victims of abuse and neglect in Minnesota in 2008. 45 of those children suffered life-threatening injuries and 17 died. These most vulnerable children are upstream. Without protection and early intervention, They are the future clients of our mental health, corrections, chemical dependency, and homeless services. Please consider alternative proposals to cut county aid, as suggested by the counties. The message that these most vulnerable of our citizens must remain a priority and that these dollars will continue to be dedicated is important. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question probably would be more appropriate for somebody from the counties, but is a county match required for the state allocation in this program area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there's no requirement for a county match, but there are certainly many county dollars in the system.
Representative Ansel.
So it's a purely a voluntary response, and it must vary from county to county as to whether or not they put property taxes into these populations. Is that correct?
Ms. Reagan.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, you're right. A county would probably be better able to answer the question, but my understanding is that there are many, many, many county dollars in this. It's actually a large expenditure in our state, but the point is that we have very, very few state dollars that are supporting it. We do have state requirements for what the counties need to do, but without, we don't pay for much of that.
And could you get us the, you said that that used to be, I think it was $115 million, and now it's down to, what was the time of years that it took to do that?
Well, it was in 2003 that $50 million was cut out. When we consolidated those 15 grants that were all part of what was rolled into this fund, $50 million was cut at that point. And then the allotment was the additional cut.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of dovetailing on that, can you give us an idea of the caseloads, how those have increased over the years?
Ms. Regan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, I can't, but I'm sure the counties could.
Other questions? Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. And next we have Tim Rundle. Yeah. Before we do that, we now have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Rundle. I'm a board member of the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, and I also serve as a public policy chair of that. I'm the proud father of a very amazing, courageous young man who had a car accident when he was 18 years old. He sustained a traumatic brain injury and was in a coma that he was never supposed to wake from. When he did wake from his coma, the first thing I taught him was two blinks meant yes, so we could communicate. The next thing I told him was three blinks, each blink representing a word, those words being, I love you. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns about the governor's budget. Due to time constraints, I'll only focus on one area. We are opposed to the elimination of adult therapy coverage in MA and Minnesota care. The governor's budget calls for the elimination of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy from the medical assistance menu of covered services. He says people can get those through Medicare. You should all know that Social Security rules require a person to wait for 2 years after becoming disabled before they can even apply for Medicare. It takes a long time for the brain to heal from an injury. Getting back to normal is never a foregone conclusion. The medical community refers to the first 2 years as a prime time for recovery. By eliminating the very therapies that allow people to find their normal, the governor's proposal may very well assure that the person with a brain injury will not be able to function in as high a degree of self-sufficiency and only increases the likelihood of needing the very home and community-based services that are slowly being dissolved in the areas of the budget. Let me tell you a brief story about how these therapies affected my family. After my son was stabilized, he was sent to an acute rehabilitation hospital where he received physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. Luckily, he had that option and made tremendous progress considering he wasn't supposed to ever wake from the coma he was in. In fact, they were able to remove the trach, which had been in place for 3 months since his accident. We were thrilled with the progress of his recovery. I know I don't have the time to talk about the limitations of our current system, but in fact, these services were eventually reduced for him. The point is, without the therapies, my son's health started to deteriorate, eventually followed by respiratory failure, resulting in a one-month stay in an ICU ward, followed by 3 more months in a respiratory care hospital. I did a little research to see what this would cost. Based on average ICU and respiratory care costs, the 4 months my son was hospitalized cost approximately $560,000. This could have been prevented if my son had adequate therapy services. Eventually, our family found a way to provide the therapy my son needs, and he has not been hospitalized for long-term care since, and that was 4 years ago. Remember, we qualified for therapy early on. I can't imagine what the cost to the state would be if I make individuals wait for 2 years before they can get these services. I know not everybody who does not get these services will cost $500,000 like my son did, but it's not going to take long before the governor's $1.8 million in savings will be blown away by acute care cost. This is unethical, and it will not save money. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, thank you for your testimony. And next, Maureen O'Connell. And after that, it's going to be Ann Quincy. That's two Irish people in a row. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And I am going to offer you quite the deal today. I'm going to do the testimony of three people and not take 15 minutes. So to start off with, I'll put my Deborah Schlick hat on. Deborah Schlick is the Executive Director of the Affirmative Options Coalition. And she has had a medical issue come up and can't make it today. So she's going to follow up with you in writing. But she also just asked me if I would testify to the governor's recommendation regarding refinancing $28 million of emergency TANF money, which is available to Minnesota under the federal stimulus bill through the tax committee. Those funds would more than pay for the cuts the governor has proposed to families with disabled parents and children, as well as to cutting back funding for short-term skill-building jobs. The federal government made these funds available to prevent just these sorts of cuts. We would urge the legislature not to transfer the $28 million to the tax committee and instead use it in this committee to help TANF recipients. And so Deborah is going to follow up with you in writing. So that proved to you that I can be short. And so now I'm going to turn and I'm going to put on the hat of Ann Quincy. Ann is a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis and works in the benefits unit. And she works daily to help families and single adults establish eligibility for benefits like SSI, MFIP, and GA, as well as a host of other public programs. The rules for these programs are complex, and establishing and then maintaining one's eligibility can take a long time and a lot of paperwork. Legal Aid works with people every day who will be dramatically impacted by the proposed changes to Minnesota's human services programs and who will lose their housing, their connection to medical care, and their ability to meet their basic needs. First, I'd like to talk about the proposal to include SSI and MSA benefits in determining MFIP eligibility. Cutting NFIP assistance to families with disabled children or adults will have a drastic financial impact on these families. Right now, a family of five with one disabled child receives $674 per month in SSI for the child with a disability, and $697 in NFIP cash for the other four members of the family. Under the governor's proposal, that family would see the immediate loss of almost half of their income. They would be eligible for only $13 in NFIP funding. This drastic cut to the already meager income of these families is certain to increase homelessness and out-of-home placement for children. Counting the SSI income defeats the intent of the SSI program. If the SSI recipient is a child with severe mental or physical disabilities, the purpose of the grant is to provide for the child's special and complicated medical needs. While the caretaker is the one who receives the SSI payment, they receive the funds as representative payee, and federal law requires the representative payee to use the SSI payment to meet the disabled child's needs, not the needs of the other children in the family. Directing the parent representative payee to use the SSI of a disabled child to support the rest of the family, we believe violates federal law and will not be allowed by the Social Security Administration. Similarly, the purpose of the SSI program is to provide income to disabled adults who cannot work and are not able to support other members, of the family also. The group of families on NFIP with a household member or members with disabilities are the most vulnerable families in NFIP, the most unlikely to be able to work their way off NFIP. The legislature recognized this in 2007 when it repealed the provision that required counting up to $125 in SSI benefits against the family's NFIP grant. This proposal to decrease NFIP dollar for dollar for the receipt of SSI magnifies the pain on families with members with a disability 100-fold. The other proposal that I'd also like to testify to is the proposal to eliminate general assistance. The department's fact sheet doesn't say, but to be clear, Minnesotans receiving a general assistance grant get $203 a month to meet all of their basic life expenses except food. So with $203, they must pay rent, transportation, clothing, hygiene products. If they are in group residential housing, GA recipients only get a personal needs allowance, but their housing is paid for. So people with no housing support get $203 a month. As you can imagine, many are homeless, staying in a shelter or on someone's couch or in their garage. A lucky few live in subsidized housing where they pay one-third of their income for rent. In order to get GA, a person must show they cannot work, and most do this with a doctor's certification that they are too ill to work. In fact, many also meet the Social Security definition of disability and that they cannot work due to their medical condition for at least a year. But the average wait for applying for SSI to be found disabled is more than 1 year. When they win their SSI case, Minnesota is reimbursed for all of the GA that was paid. Most of our clients waiting for an SSI hearing are on GA. People like Gary. He was 54 when he applied for SSI. He lived with his mother, who was on a fixed income, and he used his GA to contribute to what he could toward their housing expenses. Gary is developmentally delayed and mentally ill. and hasn't been able to work since his 20s. He can't read or write more than his name. So when he came to us for help, it was primarily for help dealing with the paperwork for his GA and his GMC. We helped him do that, despite Social Security regulations specifying that someone with an IQ as low as Gary's was disabled. He waited through two appeals and a year and a half to win his SSI case. With no means of support during that long wait for disability benefits, how would Gary have gotten to the bus, to the county office, or to the doctor? Under the proposal to move people like Gary from GMC to Minnesota Care, how would he pay the premiums so he could see a doctor? Food stamps helped Gary and his mom buy food, but what about the clothing and hygiene products? There are many GA recipients in Minnesota who aren't as lucky as Gary. They don't live with a relative or have someone like Gary's mom to help. Proposing to cut off all means of support to these Minnesotans is incomprehensible. I'm going to turn it over to Boyd Brown, who is going to tell you a few stories about the SSI cut that I described.
Ms. O'Connell, could you send me, just email me, a description of what you said about the SSI for the disabled child and what that did to the...
Yes, I'll be happy to do that.
Cut their budget in half.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to testify today. The focus, as Maureen mentioned today, that I'm going to talk about is MFIP families with disabled parents and children and SSI who will be impacted by the dollar-for-dollar MFIP cash assistance reduction. Before I go on, I'd like to make clear that Goodwill Easter Seals will see no financial gain or loss by a change in this MFIP policy and will continue to provide services for these families who are here solely today out of the concern for the families we serve. Goodwill Easter Seals is more than a retail store that you shop at or donate to. We are a statewide workforce development agency, providing employment-related services to people with barriers to education, employment, and independence. One way we meet this mission is by providing Social Security advocacy services. Through this program, we serve over 300 families a year who need assistance in applying for SSI benefits, and most of these families are on MFIP. Due to the nature of this service, we learn about all facets of their lives, and today I want to share some insight and knowledge about these families just through two stories, Georgia and Monica. You may ask why they're not here testifying. I think after you hear these stories, you'll understand why. And also, these stories are not outliers, but what we see and experience every day in our jobs. First, Georgia. Georgia is a current participant in our program in the process for applying for Social Security benefits. 2 years ago, Georgia was married with two children. She always struggled with depression, but was able to manage her responsibilities, and she was able to hold a job and care for her children. Her husband left her suddenly, and she spiraled downward into a deep depression. Her diagnosis, major depression, severe, recurrent, and anxiety disorder with agoraphobia. What does this mean for her? She basically doesn't leave her home unless she absolutely has to. She leaves about approximately one time per month. Without her sister, most daily activities would not be completed, such as grocery shopping, cleaning her home, running errands, etc. While her children are in school, she spends most of her day in bed. At night, she is unable to sleep due to her racing thoughts and worries. In the past year, due to her financial situation, she has been homeless three times for several months at a time. She and her children have stayed in shelters and with her sister. As you can imagine, the stress and trauma of homelessness significantly exacerbated her symptoms. The good news is we do fully expect her to get on Social Security benefits, which will improve her financial situation, but it will still remain quite precarious. We have found in many situations that with improved financial stability, our participants are much more likely to engage in mental health treatment to improve their emotional well-being. However, with this proposed reduction, Georgia may once again end up homeless and continue this cycle of stress and trauma for her family. The second story I'd like to share with you is Monica. She's 44 years old. She's separated from her husband with two sons, ages 16 and 7 years old. Her 16-year-old son is autistic and has a genetic disorder characterized by developmental delays, speech impairment, and movement disorders, seizures, and behavioral impairments. Her younger son has ADHD. Her older child does receive Social Security, and the MFIP is currently on MFIP cash assistance and food support. Monica is a college graduate and held stable employment for many years until last spring when she fled a domestic violence situation with her husband of 10 years. She has very little social support and found herself and her children homeless. Monica and children initially lived in a domestic violence shelter, but now, luckily, have found stable housing through Model City's housing program. Monica also has mental health issues, including bipolar disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and ADHD. Some of her biggest challenges have been adjusting to this new life as a single parent and obtaining services for her children and herself. A reduction in any amount of cash support for this family receives would have tremendously a negative impact on the family's already stretched budget. I just urge you to remember these two families and all the families we serve when you deliberate and vote on this proposed MFIP policy change. Thank you.
Thank you. And could you state, Mr. Brown, what your organization is?
It's Goodwill Easter Seals.
Okay. And are there questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. O'Connell. Can you talk a little more about, we've talked a little bit about Social Security repaying folks that get on SSI. Can you talk about when that happens and kind of the tech, I guess what I think, and you can tell me if this is wrong, is that once they apply, even if they get denied a couple of times, but if they eventually get on, that the federal government repays the county from the time in which they apply, or does that work differently than that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. When you apply for general assistance, you sign an agreement and that you'll apply for SSI, and that you will have, and if you receive SSI, then you've authorized the state to collect your GA from the SSI lump sum payment if you're found disabled. And so at the time of application, you sign that sort of agreement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
And then would that include if they got on GRH or any of the other programs that the state was providing for that individual?
Ms. O'Connell.
I don't know the answer to Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't know specifically about GRH. I do know that in the healthcare area, that once you are found disabled under the SSI regulations, then the state, and if you've been on general assistance medical care, then the state can go back and essentially bill the medical assistance folks and get the GAMC paid for by medical assistance.
Okay.
And Ms. O'Connell, how many months can they collect for the GAMC spending?
I think they can go, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe, and I can follow up with the committee, but I think they can go back 2 years and collect for any medical assistance. But I will check on that.
Because I'm confused. I thought they could go back for the 2 years, but somebody told us yesterday or the day before that it's only 3 months. If you get on to,
I was trying to think where. Now I know 3 months is not right, and this is all done through the state's accounting system, and I think every month the state is going back after they receive after an SSI disability determination is made, they go back and they. And they do the accounting to change it from GMC to medical assistance. So I understand it's on a monthly basis, and I know they can go back further than 3 months. So I will get you the information
on that.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next, it's Mark McAfee from AFSCME Council 5, and he'll be followed by Bruce Nelson.
Bruce is at his rally. He'll be a little late, so we'll skip it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, I'm Mark McAfee, legislative representative of AFSCME Council 5. We represent about 43,000 workers throughout Minnesota, including state, county, municipal, school district, university, hospital, and long-term care workers. To us, the governor's budget reads like a Charles Dickens novel. I haven't decided which one. I'm thinking perhaps Bleak House. He cuts programs for those afflicted with mental illness and chemical dependency, slashes programs for children. He whacks services for the disabled and the elderly. He knocks the poor down when they need a hand up. All that's missing from this story is a debtor's prison. Here are some items of concern to us. Services for the mentally ill are cut in the governor's budget. I know you've heard, and we don't know which one yet. There'll be a state-operated services mental health facility closed with a reduction of 29 FTEs. And we have to be concerned whenever we close such a facility about access to care. The end allotment of $5 million in state-operated services would be made permanent. And we hope as you go forward, before you make final decisions, that you'll get more information from Dr. Sulik, et cetera, as to how that would all unfold. You heard earlier, I mean, we've had grants to counties for child mental health case management, reduced grants for counties for housing support, and case management for adults with serious mental illness. And adult mental health day treatment hours would be reduced. Elderly and disabled persons needing continuing care will see a decline in services and worsening care. The governor's proposal to cut all long-term care providers by 2.5% stands. This will hit the MSOCs, group homes, ICFMRs, such as Lake Wasa residents, and nursing homes hard. It may accelerate closure of some facilities. Services for the chemically dependent will see 5% cut to providers starting in FY 2011. Children, their families will be hard hit. 5% cut to the basic sliding fee child care grants, 5% cut to the child care assistance program. And you heard earlier from Mary, the state grant to counties, block grants to provide social services for children, adolescents, and others would be extended. Healthcare services and research would also be cut. Part of the cigarette tax money that's now used for medical education and research grants, known as MERC, would be stubbed out. Hospitals under this budget would take an inpatient rate reduction. People will come in and out of Minnesota care like a revolving door and slam up against that $10,000 inpatient limit, which you all know only so well. You've just heard others speak of financial programs for the poor, like general assistance and work supports for MFIP participants are cut. How are people going to pay for Minnesota care co-pays or premiums without GA? What will they do? Where will they stay? We just feel, once again, during this time of severe recession, people need the safety net that many health and human service programs offer. And I think we should think of the safety net not just as something that catches somebody like a somebody that falls off a trapeze, but rather something that people are able to grab a hold of, and then it's all about helping people help themselves. But it's very tough to go out and get a job when you know, child care and health care, everything else is cut. We should be maintaining these programs rather than cutting them, although we know we're going to see some cuts, and we know you folks have a tough job. And find new revenue sources to mitigate budget cuts. And I think on the revenue sources, we know the governor won't take a lot of new revenue, but I would counsel you to be open to creative options as we go forward. There may be some way, somehow, to get some new revenue that may fund some program somewhere. So don't sweep it off until you get close to the end. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And just to remind us that the governor's not the only one at the table as we kind of want to resolve these budget crises.
I agree with you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Is Bruce Nelson here yet? Oh, okay, we'll come back to him. Steve Larson?
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'm going to let Denise Miller testify since she took off from work to be here along with Steve Hayes, and I'll come back tomorrow evening.
Okay. So state your name for the tape, please.
Hi, my name is Denise Miller, and I work full-time at Unisys Corporation in Roseville. My 24-year-old son, Andrew, was born with a birth defect. He cannot walk, and so he uses a power wheelchair. He has been ventilator-dependent since he was 6 months old. He requires 24 hours per day skilled private duty nursing care. He can turn blue at a moment's notice, which requires immediate nursing intervention. These blue episodes occur daily. He can turn blue with simple things like laughing, crying, bending over, eating, just to name a few. He lives at home with us. Since insurance will only pay for 50 hours per year, the rest of his private duty nursing care is paid through medical assistance. I am very concerned about the new provider rate cut of 2.5% on top of the 2.58% that was imposed July 1st, 2009. What is the incentive for the nurses to stay at my house and take care of my son? He cannot have a nurse take care of him that just graduated from college. He needs someone that has experience with emergency situations and an intensive level of care. Pay in a hospital is not decreasing. Yes, there are layoffs occurring at area hospitals, but the nurses that care for my son are specialized. They have intensive care background and could easily step right back into the hospital setting. Some people would say that home care nurses have great hours and wouldn't want to go back to a hospital. This is not true. The nurses that take care of my son work nights, weekends, and holidays. The home care nurses get minimal benefits compared to benefits they could get in a hospital. We cannot compete with the hospitals. Keeping these nurses at my house will be difficult with another provider rate cut. Andrew is a viable member of the community. He volunteers daily at Bridgeview School in St. Paul using computer software that enables him to create symbols and picture boards that are used at students by students at Bridgeview who cannot speak. These picture boards allow the students to communicate with other students and the teachers. The special education teachers put in requests to Andrew for their specific boards to be made. This saves the teachers a lot of time they don't have due to the increased class size. They just love him there. He is transported to Bridgeview via a day training and habilitation program. This transportation service would also be affected by the 2.5% provider rate cut. Thank you for giving me this time to tell my story. Please do not allow another provider rate cut of 2.5% to go through, especially now with the new improved budget forecast. This rate cut would be devastating to my son and our family. Thank you again.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. So, and this must be
Steve Hayes.
Steve Hayes, there it is.
Right. Good afternoon. My name is Steve Hayes. My wife Maureen and I are the parents of three children. Our middle child, Brett, is 19 and has numerous developmental disabilities. He doesn't talk or communicate in any way, and he needs help with everything that he does. Diapering, eating, bathing, watching TV, everything. But Brett is also completely mobile and can walk out of the house whenever he wants to and is prone to epileptic seizures, so he has to be constantly attended to throughout the day. Brett is currently on the waiting list for the developmental disabilities waiver. In fact, he's been on that list for almost 9 years. We've been told over 4,000 people are still waiting for a DD waiver.
Mr. Hayes, could you go back and tell me how long he's been waiting?
Almost 9 years. And as I said, we've been told there are over 4,000 people on this list, and so you can see that qualifying for a waiver doesn't exactly inspire much inspiration or hope on our part. But Brett is getting bigger and stronger every day, and his care is becoming more demanding. As my wife Maureen and I age, our biggest fear is our continuing physical ability to care for him. I have arthritic knees, a repaired shoulder, and have successfully weathered a bout with cancer. Maureen has had 3 surgeries in the last 10 years. We seldom stop to think about how all that stooping and bending and caregiving works on us, but it does. It eventually takes its toll. We love Brett and have made many sacrifices as a family to care for him and keep him in our home. It's easy to talk about the physical and financial sacrifices. What's more difficult is to capture the emotional losses that are really part of our everyday lives. We have never gone on a family vacation. My wife and I were unable to visit our oldest daughter during her last 4 years in college as a couple because one of us had to stay behind to care for Brett. For years, we went to separate church services, and we are always the first to leave a social event in the evening. So you get the picture. We just really don't experience a whole lot of spontaneity in our lives. And our situation is not unlike many parents of children with disabilities. We have been told that since Brett doesn't come from a crisis situation, he's unlikely to get a waiver anytime soon. It seems cruel, but unless we prove our family is dysfunctional or broken, or both of us are completely unable to care for Brett, that he will never receive the services that he needs to thrive in our community. While waiting for a waiver, we are grateful that Brett receives PCA services. He qualifies for 12 hours a day. So you're probably thinking, 12 hours a day, what's the problem? Well, the problem is Brett gets no consistency of care. We have high school and college age kids in our house all the time. There are often 3 different people in a day that watch Brett. A month ago, I woke Brett up and gave him his 11 pills that he gets every morning and fed him breakfast. 2 hours later, his 19-year-old PCA gave him another 11 pills, not checking to see that I had already done that. Brett spent 5 hours doubled over on the couch, coughing and retching, and since he can't talk, it took us a day to figure out what went wrong. It's not easy to find capable PCA help today, and as Brett gets bigger and more challenging, we worry about the ability of this service to really meet his needs in the years ahead. What we are asking for is some assurance that Brett's long-term basic care needs will be met. He needs to live in a licensed, well-managed group home facility, and that, in this day and age, is not possible without a waivered services allocation. We can't keep closing our eyes to the funding shortfall for waiver allocations. It's critical to the health of thousands of Minnesota families. While our children's needs increase, our ability as parents to care for them decreases. Too many families have passed their breaking point waiting for a waiver, and I fear the next major collapse in this state won't be a bridge, it's going to be the family, because its foundational supports are much weaker than most people realize. We can't let that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank both testifiers for testifying today. And this is the frustrating part, and I just want to remind folks that it seems like we've been our programs are cannibalizing each other. You know, in order to prevent a rate cut, we slow down or we limit or we cap the growth of waivers. And I think both of those options are unfortunate, and that's what's happened last year. You know, at the expense of waivers, we try to reduce rate cuts, and both are absolutely and dearly needed for families and for those wonderful people who work so hard and not get nearly enough pay for the work that they do. And I just wanted to remind folks that, you know, waivers shouldn't be at the expense of rates, and rates shouldn't be at the expense of waivers, because they go hand in hand.
Other questions, comments? Okay, well, thank you both for your testimony.
And there are copies of my testimony available if anybody care to have it.
Thank you. Is Bruce here? Richard Derricks, Dental Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Dick Derricks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Minnesota Dental Association represents 3,500 dentists and dentists in training in Minnesota. I have two concerns with the governor's supplemental budget that I would like to highlight for you today. First, the governor recommends modifying the Critical Access Dental Provider Program eligibility criteria, and by so doing, reducing $3 million in expenditures for this program from the Health Care Access Fund. The modification to the criteria restricts critical access dentists to nonprofit clinics only. This is a highly objectionable approach and would set dental access back severely, especially in greater Minnesota. The Minnesota Dental Association worked with the legislature to create this program in 2001, and it has allowed 50,000 more MHCP patients to receive dental care than otherwise would be the case. The Critical Access Dental Program provides increased reimbursements to both private practice and nonprofit dental clinics who see substantial numbers of public program patients. On allotments in 2009 reduced the Critical Access Dental Program by $6 million, and those reductions are already having a devastating effect on access to dental care for the underserved in the state. The criteria for dental clinic eligibility proposed in the supplemental budget would eliminate all private practice dental offices from the Critical Access Dental Program, and this would be especially devastating to greater Minnesota, where there are extremely few nonprofit clinics to see public program patients. If $3 million needs to be cut, and I sincerely hope that it does not, there are other approaches to address eligibility criteria that would not be so devastating to dental access in greater Minnesota. Representative Bunn has been discussing alternative approaches to the criteria with dental stakeholders, and her House File 3269 contains a more acceptable approach toward critical access program criteria. The Health Policy Committee is scheduled to hear that bill on Thursday. I strongly encourage you to reject outright the critical access dental proposal in the supplemental budget and to support dental access in greater Minnesota and the entire state through all dental providers. Second topic I would like to bring to your attention in the supplemental budget is the elimination of the highly successful Donated Dental Services, or DDS, program. The DDS program is supported with a grant from the Minnesota Department of Health and costs $63,000 a year from the Health Care Access Fund. The DDS program matches dentists who volunteer free care with patients who meet eligibility criteria and dental labs who donate dental services for the dentist's care of the patient. Patients who receive care through the DDS program are the elderly and the disabled who do not have the financial ability to pay for the dental care that they need. These are and they usually provide large case care to these patients. The $63,000 appropriation to the Department of Health in fiscal year 2010, the current year, will leverage $850,000 in donated dental care to approximately 230 aged and disabled patients. This is a 15-to-1 ratio whereby $15 of dental care is donated by dentists for each dollar spent. Approximately 400 dentists are active volunteers in this program. This payback ratio is extremely cost effective. I encourage you, strongly encourage you, to maintain the $63,000 appropriation out of the Health Care Access Fund for the Donated Dental Services program. The dollars are small, but the impact is big. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today, and I would be pleased to respond to any questions that you might have.
Are there questions? I liked your 18-to-1 or 15-to-1.
15-to-1.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and I understand Bruce Nelson is now here. And after Bruce, we'll have Kathleen Picard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers who support people with disabilities in the ICFMR, CADI, CAC, TBI waivers, CDCS, and home care, and any other type of service you can think of, just about. I am very disappointed in the governor's budget. Instead of taking a balanced approach, he chose to look at our most vulnerable people, our elders. I'm almost one of those. And other people most in need, people with disabilities and their caregivers, and people in economic crisis, people without health insurance. Now, I'm not elderly yet, and I don't have a debilitating disability. And I'm fortunate to be pretty healthy, to have a good job, to have health insurance. I might see some impact from the governor's budget in some local services, my kids' tuition at college. But by and large, I get off scot-free. And I think that's bad policy, to balance the budget on those most in need, the most vulnerable people, the people in this recession and economic crisis. So I urge you to take a balanced approach that more fairly spreads the pain to people like me who are fortunate enough to be really part of the solution, and I'm not. Now, ARM, we have put measures forward. Representative Thiessen, in his legislation last year, and another bill will be heard tonight, to reform our disability system so that by 2012 we'll consolidate 11 different statutes and rules into one set of standards based on quality and outcomes. Save the state money, to save providers money, to be able to put more of our precious dollars into caregivers' hands and into services for people with disabilities. This will come to fruition in 2012. And I was really disappointed that the governor, we're working very closely with his department, did not recognize that work that we've put forward in the last 2 years. So I urge you, finally, with the news today, to use some of that $209 million to buy back the cut on our most vulnerable people, our elders, people with disabilities. I know you have a lot of difficult decisions to make, and there's lots of people in need, but I do ask you to seriously look at, I don't know if you call it new money, but less no money, and to help out our most vulnerable people. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Nelson and Ms. Picard.
Good afternoon, Chairman Huntley and committee members. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a physical therapist, and I serve on the board of directors for the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. Minnesota APTA is strongly opposed to the governor's proposal to eliminate physical therapy services along with occupational therapy and speech-language pathology services for adults under state health plans in all settings except hospitals. We make two arguments. First, on humane grounds, I ask that you just think about the devastating impact on the personal lives of individuals who will suffer strokes, spinal cord injuries, and other severe traumas, and individuals who do suffer from Parkinson's disease and other such conditions as multiple sclerosis and the like. All that will have been taken away will not be restored, and these individuals will be sentenced to a life without fully realizing their potential and may live in long-term care facilities, some of which would be very, very long term. This is a very enormous personal price that we are asking them to pay. Our second argument is economic. Under this proposal, low-cost services designed to restore health and function would be eliminated, and there would certainly be an immediate adverse financial impact. Patients who would receive their only rehab services in the hospital would be receiving them at the most costly environment. Those who are fortunate enough not to be discharged to long-term care facilities and do go home may not go back to work, may not have income, may not pay taxes. As Minnesota leads the nation in health care reform, it makes no sense to deny the very services that keep individuals moving and active and healthy. It makes no sense to put limits on physical therapy services to the hospital setting. And even with the add back that the governor proposes, that 70% of the savings that will be accruing from the elimination of rehab services be put back into the hospitals, there is no regulation, there is no requirement, nor there should there be a requirement that the hospitals keep individuals in the hospital long enough to fully provide their rehab services to restore movement and function. This is especially true for acute injuries that have no place for care in the hospital and could be better managed in the outpatient setting. The focus of your health care reform efforts in recent years has been on the management of chronic illnesses. There's been a lot of talk about asthma, about diabetes, medical conditions, but we forget oftentimes that there are neuromuscular conditions, musculoskeletal conditions that are also chronic illnesses and are costly to manage. Examples of those, as I mentioned, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and even chronic low back pain is considered a chronic illness. Under the governor's proposal, the very services needed to manage these chronic illnesses are being eliminated. And many of the individuals who suffer from these conditions are high risk for falls and fractures, and just like everyone else, are at high risk for the complicating illnesses associated with inactivity. As an association, we're very aware of your fiscal and moral dilemma. We have been working with Representative Bunn to seek a solution that rectifies some of your budget woes without completely eliminating physical therapy from services to these people, except in the hospital setting. We are seeking a balanced approach. We urge you to oppose the governor's cuts to physical therapy under these state-funded programs and seek a way to assure that the great strides that you have made in healthcare reform continue in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
The first one relates to the hospital. Is that inpatient, outpatient, or just inpatient?
Inpatient.
Okay, so you'd have to be admitted to the hospital to... Okay, and let me ask you if you think my understanding of this is correct, that when the fiscal noted this proposal and the elimination of out-of-hospital physical therapy, that the result of that would be people staying in the hospital longer, so that 70% of the savings really aren't there.
Correct.
Good question.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wondered if you could answer this. When I was a nurse in the nursing home, and you know, a patient would come in from the hospital who had had a stroke, in order to receive Medicare payment, they had to qualify for services, and that was occupational and physical therapy, speech therapy, and you know, those services that are being cut. So then, would that no longer be the case where Medicare won't be paying for those services because that patient won't be receiving those services? So then we will suffer the loss of that Medicare payment for that person in the nursing home?
Chair Huntley, Representative Fritz, in the nursing home, it's my understanding that there are two kinds of stay, a Part A stay and a Part B stay under Medicare. A Part A stay would be considered institutional as if it was inpatient care, and those rehab in that situation would be maintained. In a Part B stay would be considered an outpatient, in the outpatient category, and rehab services to those individuals would be eliminated.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, and Ms. Picard, thanks for coming. You're not Ms. Picard?
We have another question.
I beg your pardon.
That's okay. I just was curious. This isn't one of the choices I would have made in trying to balance a budget, because I understand the value of the three different services you were talking about here. Have you had the opportunity to talk with any of the department staff to kind of get an idea of what their rationale was?
No, we were provided by with data from Department of Human Services so that we could look at how many dollars have been spent in the various professions and how many patients were served, but we did not get answers as to why those services have been cut.
Mr. Chair, just it seems like with even a 70% add back that 70 is awfully close to 100, you know, and it just seems like if you're trying to in a lot of these, I mean, I'm not in this, all this testimony, I have heard this now for like, you know, 6 years or something, and I'm, but anyway, as I try to think, how can we help part of these little, you know, elements that are there, how do we look at the big picture? It seems like the good news for your part is with the 70% add back, that there's some room to work on that compared just to a frank cut in rates or something. So I hope we can come up with that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And who's next here? I don't think he's here. Oh, there he is. Lawrence Massa from Hospital Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our state's 147 hospitals and 17 health systems. In addressing the governor's supplemental budget recommendations, I'd like to share our view on the entire landscape facing Minnesota's hospitals during these difficult times. We're now facing a worst-case scenario, with GAMC enrollees being automatically and temporarily enrolled in MinnesotaCare. We believe that this means less access to appropriate health care for low-income residents and significant increases in uncompensated care for Minnesota's hospitals, on top of the cuts recommended by the governor in his supplemental budget. I won't go into all the detail that I provided in my written testimony, but if you look at the fiscal note that's been provided on this transition of GAMC to MinnesotaCare, you see that a lot fewer people remain enrolled in MinnesotaCare. So we're increasing the number of uninsured in Minnesota with this action, and that's going to mean more uncompensated care. You know very well the issue of the deductibles and copays, the inpatient camp. I won't go into that, and also the issue of being able to enroll new folks who show up in hospital emergency rooms and the impact that has on hospitals' uncompensated care. The bottom line is that Minnesota's hospitals will be hard hit by the elimination of GAMC, and we certainly hope that legislators will continue to work on a GAMC fix as part of the overall budget solution. With regard to the specifics in the governor's supplemental recommendations, again, more individuals will see their care, their coverage in MinnesotaCare eliminated. The governor's proposal would take adults without children making more than 75% of the federal poverty guidelines out of MinnesotaCare in order to be able to fund the movement of GAMC recipients into the program, drastically changing the MinnesotaCare program from its initial intent. Again, using the estimates of the Department of Human Services, at least 21,500 more Minnesotans will lose coverage at a time when they are most vulnerable in the current economy. This will lead to increased health care costs as this population loses access to primary care coverage and clinics and will, without a doubt, increase hospitals' uncompensated care. We've used a very conservative approach and have estimated that if hospitals receive 26% of MinnesotaCare payments, the hospital portion of the savings from this move will amount to $33 million in lost payments. That number could easily be doubled or even tripled if MinnesotaCare enrollees turn to hospital emergency rooms as their sole source of health care or allow their preventable or treatable conditions to languish until emergency or inpatient hospitalization is required. The governor's supplemental recommendations inflict further pain on the hospital community through reductions that will cost millions in federal reimbursements, doubling the impact of state savings to our member hospitals. Let me give some examples. Delaying Medicaid rebasing saves the state $8.6 million, but will cost hospitals $19.7 million when lost federal dollars are included. Reducing Medicaid and MinnesotaCare inpatient rates by 3% saves the state $9 million, but again costs hospitals $19 million. Eliminating the rural DRG add-on payment saves the state $2 million, but will cost our rural hospitals $4.5 million. Cutting medical education and research costs, or MERC funding, saves the state $21.3 million, but will cost hospitals $44.3 million and will create considerable instability in the teaching mission of many of our members. In addition, the governor's budget does not show how hospitals will be impacted when quarterly DSH payments or disproportionate share hospital payments are eliminated. However, the Department of Human Services currently has a state plan amendment request into the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that includes a proposal to use MinnesotaCare payments as the leveraging mechanism rather than GAMC payments for these funds. The state then proposes keeping the DSH dollars rather than continuing to make quarterly payments to hospitals as intended. Such a diversion of federal money from its intended purpose to help offset hospitals' uncompensated care and Medicaid losses to propping up state fund balances should be shown in the budget pages as a proposed cut to hospitals. There is certainly additional information that MHA can provide you in the days ahead to show what these proposed cuts mean to our hospitals and the patients that we serve. But to put it simply, our options are limited. You will likely see additional job losses in hospitals, you will see the reduction in hospital services, and you will see additional costs shifting to private payers. In closing, I would like to share with you a simple pie chart that illustrates how Governor Pawlenty is once again proposing to solve this budget shortfall by slashing into Minnesota's health care system. Of the $825 million in proposed cuts, $347 million would come from cuts to Health and Human Services. That's 42% of the proposed budget cuts. Health and Human Services is only 30% of the entire budget. We believe cuts need to be made more broadly and more proportionately to all areas of state spending, and we also agree that additional revenues need to be considered as part of the mix. We urge you to work with your colleagues, those who serve on this committee and those who do not, those who participate in your party's caucus and those who do not, and find alternatives to the governor's proposals. A failure to do so would undoubtedly impact access to effective and efficient care for a large number of Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to try to respond to your questions.
I have a question. No one has really showed me the real numbers, but in a given year, there's about 75,000 people on GAMC, and at any one time, it's about 35,000.
Right.
How many of those people do you think actually stay on the program for a long time? And the reason I'm saying that is if you transition into MinnesotaCare, there's the people that are in the program right now might be able to do that. But how about the homeless person that's brought to the hospital on April 1st and it takes 2 months now to get onto MinnesotaCare? So if you could give me an idea of how many people that would be compared to the governor saying I think about 20 on average would be in the program. But if somebody shows up at your emergency room on April 1st that is supposedly eligible for MinnesotaCare, he won't be on MinnesotaCare for 2 months after that. So what's the turnover of these people?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question.
And did you put that thought in some of your spreadsheets with us?
Well, we don't have that number. All we know is what we can discern from the department's own estimates, that the number will go down to 21,000 in 2010. We'll go from the 35,000 that are automatically enrolled into the program April 1. The department estimates that will decline to 21,000 in 2010 and further down to 15,000 in 2011. The number of new folks who would otherwise be covered by GAMC, we don't have an estimate on what that is, but we know it's somewhere between that 75,000 and the 35,000 that are enrolled. And I think some of the stories that you heard in earlier testimony are very indicative. Someone's involved in an accident, they lose a job, they have a family situation that occurs, and all of a sudden they become part of this population when they weren't prior to April 1. And our members will have to deal with that situation.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Abler.
And not to repeat them all, but if you gave some lists of some of the
the cuts and then what the federal thing was. I'd be nice to see it. Looks like you have it all in one sheet. If you just pass that out to us later, that would be...
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we do have a handout that identifies that. You should have just received
it. Oh, okay. Thanks. I'll read my mail.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Massa, I'm interested when you talk about one of your suggestions was to spread the cuts more broadly. Can you give a little definition as to what you mean by more broadly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, I guess our concern, and we've expressed this in the past, when the governor takes 43% of the state budget off the table to begin with, that means that the cuts to Health and Human Services have to be larger. So we think the cuts to those agencies that have been held harmless need to at least be considered as part of the mix when you balance all of the impact of the state's economic shortfall.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could...
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That 43%, what is those categories that would be 43%?
I believe those categories, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, those categories include K-12 education. I believe it involves some public safety programs and services to veterans.
Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer, in the budget we passed last year... Health and Human Services is about 30% of the budget, and we got nearly 70% of the cuts. Okay, thank you, Mr. Massa. And I think we have time for one more.
Yes.
Jim Hadigan from Gillette Children's Hospital.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Deal. I represent Gillette, and I'm on the board of Gillette. My important role here today was to save a seat for Jim. And I wanted to frame our presentation. Gillette was established by the legislature in 1897, and we've had a 113-year mission to provide services for children with disabilities. Our function, as defined by this legislature that many years ago, is to take children who would otherwise struggle through life, provide them with the necessary medical and, in the earlier years, educational services that made them productive adults. And as I listen to the other witnesses here, I'm reminded of our former board colleague, recently deceased Dick Ducharme, who was a man of small stature. His legs didn't work, but he was an enormously successful businessman, husband, father, and his greatest joy in life was that his father decided to keep him. These families that take their beloved children and help them in this struggle when they have so many cards stacked against them is awesome. And our role is to do our little piece, primarily medically, to do this. We thought we would be here today because Gillette has the highest percentage of Medicaid patients of any hospital in Minnesota. So these decisions impact us, and Jim is the guy who can tell you the financial impact of these changes on Gillette.
Thank you, John. Well, I'll be brief. I know we're running out of time here, but as John said, we deal primarily with people with profound disabilities, children with profound disabilities. Over 50% of our patients are covered by Medicaid. That makes us, I believe, the highest or the second highest in the state, as we are every year in terms of what's called disproportionate share. The handout that I hope all of you have received, I've actually been before this committee before, and this is a slightly updated version of what I've brought before. But the very first graph you see shows the percentage of costs that are paid by the state Medicaid program to Gillette, and that is costs, not charges. And so we are looking at getting paid only really about two-thirds, less than two-thirds of what it actually costs to do this care. The next page translates that into dollars. And as you can see, there's we're anticipating in 2010 over $12.2 million in losses. We sustained over $11 million in losses in 2009. I have been before this committee before, earlier this year, talking about a request in the bonding, and our request is entirely driven by these losses. We would rather not have to request bonding, but we do feel like we get our backs put against the wall somewhat financially. It's difficult for us to raise all the money we need for our expansions. The additional cuts will hurt us some more. We'll lose about $250,000 this year that we didn't budget for in terms of the rate cuts that will double in 2011. And then the DISH will cost us, the rebasing will cost us another $1 million in DISH. So that's not reflected in the numbers that you see before you. And we would, we would just hope that as budget deliberations go forward, that these kind of inequities are considered.
Mr. Cadigan, if half your patients or a little bit more are on MA, and MA is paying, looks like 62% of what it costs, you can't transfer that cost to anybody else, or not significant.
Not significantly, no, Mr. Chair.
And so do you just rely on fundraising, charity care, or not charity care, but gifts?
Much of it is covered by donations. I will say we do attempt to work some of it into private rates. There's a limit to that when half of your population is covered by Medicaid, to try and shift it to the other half of the patients, and then donations take up the rest. And what else happens is that we just delay expansion. That's one of the reasons we were asking for consideration in the state bonding grant, is if you don't earn the money, you don't save it, and if you don't save it, you can't spend it on equipment and buildings when you need them.
On the other hand, if you lose money on every car, you can't make it up on volume. Well, any other questions? Okay, thank you, and I have an announcement. We are not going to meet tomorrow night. We are going to meet at 9 a.m. on Friday to try to get through the rest of the public testimony. We will, however, meet on Thursday at 1 o'clock, but it won't be public. It'll just be dealing with the forecast.
For a half an hour
only. Okay, the meeting's adjourned.